Our next case is Lone Star Silicon Innovations, LLC versus Micron Technology, Inc., number 18-1578. Counselor Maloney, you reserved 3 minutes of your time for rebuttal, is that correct?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
You have reserved 3 minutes of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, 3 minutes.
Okay, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, Lone Star properly brought the underlying actions without naming AMD because Lone Star owns all exclusionary rights under the patents. AMD does not own the patents. It has no right to enforce them. It can never obtain rights to enforce them. And it has absolutely no right to influence these litigations in any way. The dismissal of the actions was therefore an improper result. The district court erred as a matter of law.
Does AMD, did they reserve the right to practice the patent?
AMD received, after transferring ownership of the patents to Lone Star, Lone Star in turn granted a non-exclusive license back to AMD. And under that non-exclusive contractual license, AMD then had the right to practice. That was not a proprietary.
Does Lone Star have the right to practice?
Does Lone Star? Absolutely. Lone Star has the right to practice because Lone Star received an outright assignment of these patents. And this is a fundamental difference between the way the district court looked at the patent transfer agreement and the proper way to look at it. It's absolutely clear under sections 2.1 and 2.2 that this was an outright transfer of all right, title, and interest in the patents, all inventions and discoveries, all enforcement rights, all rights to recovery, so on and
but,
so on.
But AMD and its affiliates have the right to practice the patents, right?
AMD only have, they do have the right to practice the patents, but only
and
because...
And all distributors, resellers, customers, direct and indirect, they also are protected from any infringement claim.
They are because,
right?
And yes, and the answer
and
the
then there's
is,
a limited list of identified companies that you've been given the right to sue. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't.
Or maybe a different way to put it is.
I don't agree with the way you characterized it.
You're blocked from suing anybody unless they're on that list. Is that fair to say?
Well, I would say it more precisely, Your Honor, that having obtained outright ownership of all of the proprietary rights in the patents, which include the right to enforce against anybody, and Lone Star having therefore become the outright owner of the patents, Lone Star granted a covenant, a warranty, back to AMD. And under that warranty, Lone Star agreed not to pursue litigation against companies that were not on the list that you just referred
right.
to.
I mean,
that was,
Lone Star couldn't sue Intel if it wanted to, right? They're not on the list.
If Lone Star, if they're not on the list, then it would not be able to sue Intel without being in breach of the covenant that it gave back to AMD. The consequence of that breach would be that AMD would then have a right to sublicense Intel, not the right to sue Intel. And this is critically important because at the end of the day, this court affirmed and really emphasized in its Abbott decision that the right of ownership of a patent includes the right to indulge infringement. A patent owner, of course, has the right to grant a sublicense, in this case, a sublicense to AMD, as the owner, Lone Star, also had the right to covenant that it would not sue certain companies. Anytime a patent owner covenants not to sue a company, it doesn't lose ownership of the patent or lose its right to pursue companies that are not subject to such a covenant.
But we're
and
not
that's
suggesting
exactly what
that you've
here.
Lost all rights to the patent. What the court below is suggesting is that you did not have all substantial rights conferred through this agreement, through this transfer agreement.
And we disagree with that because We have to look at the agreement for what it was. It was a two-step agreement. In step one, outright ownership was transferred to Lone Star. Then, with that grant, as the new owner, Lone Star granted certain covenants and licenses and warranties back to AMD, including AMD's non-exclusive right to practice, which did not give AMD any enforcement rights, as well as this covenant not to sue companies that had not been previously cleared as entities that had not previously been given a license by AMD.
That's a problem here. You claim that you were granted substantially all substantive rights to the patent.
Yes.
And that you turn around and you granted back to ADM the same. Is that correct? AMD.
We did not grant AMD back all substantial rights.
No,
we did not grant AMD
granted,
any enforcement rights whatsoever. Any of the rights that matter.
You granted back substantial rights to AMD.
No, I disagree that substantial rights were granted to AMD. All of the rights granted to AMD are the type of rights that this court's prudential standing case law has acknowledged are not substantial rights. AMD retained a non-exclusive license to practice. We've cited a number of cases that confirm that such a right is not a substantial right, Azure Networks and Luminara, for example, because it didn't give AMD the right to enforce. And patent owners grant licenses all the time to third parties. If it were true that by granting a license to practice to a third party, the patent owner no longer had substantial rights, no patent owner could sue anybody after it had granted a non-exclusive right to use to a third party.
We're talking about the relationship between AMD and Lone Star, though.
Yes.
We're not talking about some random third party.
Well,
so in Diamond Coding, for example, we identified the fact that Sanyo, the original patent owner, retained the right to practice the patented technology as a factor in considering why we ultimately held that Diamond Coding, the plaintiff, didn't have all substantial rights.
That was a factor in a Diamond Coding decision. But the most significant factor in that decision, I submit, was the fact that Sanyo had, the original owner, retained significant control over the litigations that Diamond Coding was able to bring. There was a list of companies and...
What Diamond, if your white list of companies you could sue under the transfer agreement was limited to just one company? What if it was just Micron? Here are the list of companies you can sue. We're giving you this patent. And here's the list. It's Micron. Would you say that you would have been conferred all substantial rights to the patent?
Well, I'd have to know the remaining rights that were transferred. But if I understand, I think you're asking me about this PTA, if we change the list to only include one company, Micron. And I would say that would make this case on all fours with the Alfred Mann case. In the Alfred Mann case, Alfred Mann had granted to its licensee the first right to sue. And only if the licensee did not sue did Alfred Mann's right to sue vest. And so in that scenario, Alfred Mann could have the right to sue only one company. And the court said it still had all substantial rights. The reason is because once Alfred Mann had the right to sue even one company, it had complete control over that litigation. So it didn't raise any of the concerns of the prudential standing doctrine, which are, of course, to protect defendants from facing multiple claims and to make sure that third parties that have substantial enforcement rights don't have those rights implicated by the pending litigation. Here, AMD has no enforcement rights and can never obtain any enforcement rights. And therefore, these pending cases don't put any of the defendants at the risk of facing multiple claims, nor do they implicate AMD's exclusionary rights because it has none.
Wouldn't you say that restricting Lone Star's ability to sue is an enforcement right, assertion of an enforcement right?
Well, Lone Star's ability to sue is certainly an enforcement right, Your Honor. I agree with that. But I believe that's critically important to understand the structure of this PTA.
So when we add to that a limit of companies that are you cannot sue, that's another indication of an enforcement right.
That list and Lone Star's covenant not to sue parties not on the list was an exercise of Lone Star's right as the patent owner to indulge infringement. That is the principle, one of the key principles of the Abbott case. In Abbott, the plaintiff, Abbott, did not have the right.
Patent owner to indulge infringement.
Yes.
That signifies one way or another an enforcement right.
Yes, the right to indulge infringement is an enforcement right. It is a substantial right. And Lone Star exercised that right as the patent owner. It covenanted that we won't go after companies prior to being put on the list. And the significance of being put on the list was that by being put on the list, AMD was warranting that that's a company that it has never previously granted license rights to.
And this what about the limitation on recovery rights? Does that reflect an enforcement right?
The AMD's passive interest in the recoveries?
Yeah, the fact that
they're
entitled by contract to a share of anything that's recovered by Lone Star.
No, that's just a passive financial interest. It has been recognized by this court and by the Supreme Court in Rood v. Westcott as not being an enforcement right or a substantial right. It is a passive financial interest. And in Rood v. Westcott in the 1800s, the Supreme Court recognized that that's just a manner of deferred payment, and it does not convey any enforcement rights to AMD, and therefore it's not a substantial right. But to get back to your question, Your Honor, I agree that the right to indulge infringement is a substantial right, and that's where we are fundamentally looking at this differently than the district court. Lone Star, like every patent owner, has a right to grant covenants to anyone it wants to that says, I won't sue you, or I won't sue your customers, or I won't sue these other companies. That's all Lone Star did here.
You're running out of time, and let's assume that we agree with the district court that Lone Star was not conferred all substantial rights. Mm-hmm. Can you please get to the joinder question now?
Sure. We believe that the denial of Lone Star's alternative request to join AMD was an abuse of discretion. And we've cited the case law that demonstrates the favored outcome here, if Lone Star did not have independent standing, was to cure the problem by allowing Lone Star to add the absent party here, AMD. Rule 19 and cases applying Rule 19 are consistent with that. So both in the patent context, cases like independent wireless, intellectual property development, etc., and in the non-patent context, the case law and Rule 19 strongly favor joinder as opposed to dismissal. Here, Lone Star requested joinder in the alternative. That's not disputed. In fact, two of the appellees had moved under Rule 19 for failure to join. There was a delay in producing the patent transfer agreement. We acknowledge that.
Did you ever plead that you were an exclusive licensee?
We didn't use those terms, Your Honor, but there's no requirement to use any sort of magical language. What we pled was that Lone Star is the sole owner of the right title and interest in the patents and in all rights to enforce.
Your complaint alleged that you were basically an owner. You were the owner.
The owner of all right title and interest and all enforcement rights and all recovery rights.
Then how would Rule 19 play into that if you didn't plead otherwise? If all you pled was that you're an owner, how does Rule 19 apply?
Well, the district court implicitly found that AMD's presence was necessary, because it found that we didn't have substantial rights to be considered the true owner. In that circumstance, cases like independent wireless and cases under Rule 19.
You didn't plead in the alternative, did you?
We didn't plead it in the alternative, and I don't believe we had to. The case law, what we rely on is the intellectual property development case, which indicates that in order for joinder to be appropriate to cure a prudential standing problem, the plaintiff must have only had constitutional standing at the time of filing the complaint. We clearly have pled that Lone Star owns all right title and interest, all enforcement rights, all recovery rights, and that the infringement injured Lone Star. That is constitutional standing. If the plaintiff had to plead it in a certain way in order to avail itself of Rule 19, I think a lot of cases would have come out different, because the whole point of Rule 19 is going to allow you to amend your pleading to bring the party in. I think it's the wrong analysis and the wrong result to say, because we didn't characterize ourselves as an exclusive licensee, that we don't have the right, once the court disagreed with us, to fix that under Rule 19 and a prudential standing doctrine. Now, the reasons that the district court gave, in our view, were not just reasons. The first reason he gave for saying that the delay in joining AMD would be unfair was on a theory that had we joined AMD originally, we would have been forced to file the case in the Northern District of California as opposed to the Eastern District of Texas where these litigations began. And that's just incorrect. We filed these lawsuits before TC Heartland. Under the law at that time, AMD could have been and would have been joined in the Eastern District of Texas. It sells products all over the country and was subject to jurisdiction there, therefore subject to venue.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Sure. And the last reason that the judge gave for not allowing us to join AMD was this theory that the defendants were prejudiced in not having the ability to bring counterclaims for infringement against AMD and get the same timing to the damages clock for those cases. We submit, number one, the defendants, it was just kind of a throw-in argument. They never identified any potential patent infringement claims they had against AMD. And second, they were always free to sue AMD for patent infringement. We did not prevent them from doing that. And it's not a sound reason under the prudential standing doctrine, which is to protect the existing defendants, not to allow the defendants to bring independent, unrelated counterclaims against a third party. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Weed?
Weed.
Weed.
Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court got the decision right here because Lone Star did not receive all substantial rights to the patent for at least three reasons, and I think the court has touched on a couple of those. First and the most evident one is they did not gain all rights to exclude. Now, Lone Star tries to portray it as, well, they're just indulging, and they're by covenanting not to sue people who have not been approved by AMD. But the fact that AMD can later come in and say, well, we'll add someone to the list, means that, in fact, it's AMD that is indulging the infringement with respect to parties that are not on the list. So to use the example of Intel, AMD could, at some point, add Intel to the list, and then Lone Star would be able to sue. Alternatively, AMD could essentially reach a side agreement with Intel and say, you know what, pay us, and we'll agree to never put you on that list. So AMD effectively has the right to license anyone who's not currently on that list. And so Lone Star never received all of the exclusionary rights, which are a key part of patent ownership. Lone Star also, I believe it was Your Honor Judge Reyna, who asked whether Lone Star had the right to practice. And we respectfully submit that they do not. The only basis that they've given for that is going back to Section 2.1 of the agreement, which claims to be this assignment of all right, title, and interest.
Why wouldn't they have the right to practice?
Because if
under
was,
that clause.
Because if there was not an effective assignment, then they get only the rights that are actually granted explicitly in the agreement. And the agreement never talks about them practicing it. And I think what's instructive here is if you look at a case like ProPat, and which says you look at what the intent of the parties was. And clearly, there was never any intent between AMD and Lone Star that Lone Star would be practicing these patents. Lone Star is a non-practicing entity. And so there's no indication that the parties intended Lone Star to do that. And so similar to ProPat, where the agreement is silent on it, this court concluded that, therefore, no, they don't have, they weren't given a right to practice the patents. And so that's a second key provision. And that's why this case is, in fact, similar to ProPat and similar to what this court in Primatech described as a hunting license, simply an attempt to allow another party to enforce the patent. And Judge Chen, you asked the scenario, what if it was, what if the list was limited to a single company? And actually, the case that I believe is directly on point there is the Crown Dye case, because that's specifically what had happened in that case, is the patentee had attempted to assign their exclusionary rights and their right to sue, but only with respect to one infringer. And that's a case where the Supreme Court said, no, you can't divide it up that way. You cannot create these, what this court has called, hunting licenses with respect to assertions of infringement. An additional indication that Lone Star didn't receive all substantial rights, which Your Honors did not address, is the fact that there are restrictions on their ability to assign whatever rights they do have under this agreement. And that's something that the court has said in several cases is highly important. They can, whatever rights they do have, they can assign only with AMD's consent, only if they keep all of the patents together, and only if they, whoever they attempt to assign to, agrees to have the same obligations to AMD that Lone Star currently has. And so that's an indication, once again, that AMD is keeping control of the patents, of the litigation, and therefore did not in fact convey all substantial rights to the patents.
Can we get to the Rule 19 joinder question? Because that's the one that concerns me the most. And you know, Rule 19 has pretty strong language when it comes to ordering the joinder of a necessary party. And if it appears, as it may well be here, that AMD is a necessary party in order for the lawsuit to go forward, because collectively AMD and Lone Star have all the substantial rights to the patents, then why shouldn't Rule 19 AMD have been ordered to join the case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Rule 19 has strong language, but I submit this court also has strong language. In the Mentor case, the court said quite clearly that ordinarily, and this is the court's terms, ordinarily, where a plaintiff that has brought suit is found not to have standing, the suit is dismissed. So dismissal is not an odd remedy.
But there was a request to, in the alternative, if the district court were to deem Lone Star as lacking all substantial rights, then please, you know, let's join AMD.
Two points on that, Your Honor. First is that that is similar to the situation that occurred in the Field Turf case, where a very similar scenario. The party said, let us add the missing patent owner. And this court said and remanded and said, well, it's unclear from the record whether or not this particular party actually is the patent owner. But the district court on remand should either dismiss without prejudice if it believes that the standing issue can be corrected, or with prejudice if it turns out that this party is not the patentee, and so the standing issue cannot be corrected. But it was clear there that under either circumstance, whether or not it could be corrected, the district court would dismiss the case, which is exactly what the court did here. It dismissed without prejudice.
Don't we have other cases, maybe Abbott or Asymmetrics, I can't remember, that's where we had to remand the question on Rule 19. And if Rule 19 applied because the party was a necessary party and it was feasible to join them, then the district court ought to join that party.
There are certainly cases where this court has allowed joinder, and that is where the Abbott case that Your Honor cites is a good example, because if you look at the discussion there, it makes clear that standing is actually a separate question from the Rule 19 necessary party issue. And so first off, in denying standing, the district court in this case was not necessarily reaching Rule 19. The second point, and this goes to some questions that Judge Reyna asked, is that the Lone Star never pleaded that they were an exclusive licensee below.
Can a court sua sponte invoke Rule 19?
A court could sua sponte invoke Rule 19, yes. I don't believe that's what was happening in this case. But as the court recognized, though, to correct standing, even assuming that by joining AMD you could correct standing, it was not simply a question of Rule 19, but it was also a question of Rule 21, which is the addition of parties, and Rule 15, which is the amendment of the pleadings, because Lone Star had never pleaded that it was an exclusive licensee. And so under both of those standards, the court does have some discretion. And I would respectfully submit...
Why would it need to plead that it's alternatively an exclusive licensee? I guess the point is that they took the position that under this transfer agreement, they had all substantial rights. That was their view. And then they said, okay, if the district court disagrees and thinks some of the substantial rights were held back by AMD, then please order the joinder of AMD. And some of our case law has made clear that we shouldn't be too caught up in labels. You know, is this person a patent owner, as that term is used in Section 281? Is this person an exclusive licensee? It's more about who has the substantial rights and where are they located. And if the district court deems that the substantial rights are split within two companies, then why isn't it reasonable for the plaintiff here to request the second party to be joined under those circumstances?
The issue there, Your Honor, is the fact that each of the parties still has to have standing. And so it's not simply a question of getting all the rights together in one room. It's a question of each of the parties having standing. And for Lone Star to have standing, if it doesn't have all substantial rights, it needs to be an exclusive licensee. It needs to have some exclusionary right that has been violated so that it has constitutional Article III standing.
Right, and they argued all along that they do have constitutional standing, and I don't recall the district court pushing back on that argument, because after all, they do have the exclusive right to sue those companies on that whitelist. You know, that nobody else is allowed to sue those companies. And then if those companies are in fact practicing the patent and infringing the patent, then the Lone Star's rights are being violated in that instance, which is redressable through a patent infringement action. So none of that was ever pushed back on by the district court. The district court appeared to find that there was no standing because of this prudential reason of needing AMD to be in the case.
I agree, Your Honor, that the district court decided it on prudential standing grounds. I would disagree slightly in that simply because they don't have all substantial rights is the same as then saying, well, they must have at least some exclusionary right. And I point the court to the Morrow case, where you had a situation where one party undisputably had the right to sue for infringement and the sole right to sue for infringement, but did not have ownership. And the court said that the party with the right to sue did not have constitutional standing, and so therefore simply joining the party that had had ownership of the patent did not solve the standing problem. And ProPat is similar, where you had a party that had the right to sue, and so accepting Your Honor's premise that Lone Star has the right to sue the parties on the white list, that's not recognized as a constitutional injury that can be that provides standing even with the joinder of the patentee.
District court didn't say any of this, though, right?
The district court said that they had never pled that they were an exclusive licensee, so they had never pled
But Lone Star made the case for why it has constitutional standing, and the district court never addressed that question.
It
dismissed this case for lack of standing or said there was no jurisdiction because of it not of because Lone Star is technically not a patentee, as that term is used in the patent statute.
Yes, because, Your Honor, one can have constitutional standing in one of two ways, either as being the patentee or as being an exclusive licensee. And to be an exclusive licensee, there are certain requirements, including that you have a certain portion of
I wonder if it's that rigid. Do you have to be either an exclusive licensee or the patentee? Why can't it be that one party has some of the substantial rights and then another party has the other substantial rights, kind of like in diamond coating, for example, where, you know, technically there were two parties that shared, that combined had all the substantial rights. And then we indicated in that case, well, the plaintiff, diamond coating, never sought to have the other party, Sanyo, joined, and so therefore it was proper to dismiss the case.
Because I think the case law is, if not perhaps rigid, is clear that it does have to be an exclusive licensee. And so, again, the Morrow case, the Propat case, the Textile Productions case, those were all cases in which you had a attempted plaintiff which had at least some of the substantial rights but did not have exclusionary rights, which is what this court has focused on in terms of constitutional standing. And the right to sue is not the exclusionary right.
The district court dismissed this under 12b-1?
I believe the district court didn't specify, but I believe that would probably be the appropriate understanding of
and
it.
And is that appropriate to do that under this more prudential statutory standing kind of theory? I thought the Supreme Court has said, in cases like Lexmark, you know, these types of statutory standing questions aren't appropriate to be considered a jurisdictional defect. Instead, it's perhaps a failure to state a claim or something like that.
I guess I again would point the court to the Mentor case, which said that in cases where a lack of standing is found, dismissal is the ordinary response. Now, whether it would be 12b-1 or 12b-6, that's not something I think that has been addressed, and unfortunately, I'm not sure if I can address your honor's question on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll restore your time to 4 minutes. Four minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I want to start with a couple of these joinder cases. First of all, Field Turf and Microsoft Morrow both involved a circumstance where the plaintiff didn't have constitutional standing. In Field Turf, it was because the plaintiff didn't have the right to enforce. In Microsoft, it was because the plaintiff didn't have the right to license. And that's why it couldn't be fixed by joinder. Counsel referred to the Mentor case a couple of times. In that case, the Federal Circuit actually invited the plaintiff to amend the complaint during the appeal to fix a prudential standing problem. So that certainly, a case certainly doesn't stand for the proposition that adding AMD would have been inappropriate. Diamond Coating is another one. Diamond Coating was only dismissed after the plaintiff was given an opportunity to join the absent party, Sanyo, and for whatever reason decided not to try to join Sanyo. So Diamond Coating is another case that actually supports us here. Back to the standing issue, if I might.
Actually, before you go back to standing, can you had filed a subsequent litigation, you know, where I think you, among the defendants, you included AMD as a defendant?
We did file one.
Is that?
Yes, Your Honor. We have filed a case.
Is that still alive?
It is. That's a case against Micron. We filed that case. AMD refused to join voluntarily. So under the independent wireless standard, we named AMD as a defendant, and we're planning on asking the court to realign AMD as a co-plaintiff. That case was stayed in view of not only this appeal, but a number of IPR proceedings. And we have recently settled the litigation with Micron, so that case will be going away.
But how about these other defendants, appellees? Are you Are you planning on
we did not
more lawsuits against them?
We did not refile. The district court said if we did refile, we would lose essentially our priority on the claim, and we would lose roughly a year's worth of damages. So we felt the better course was to appeal. We believe we have the right to proceed without AMD, and we believe we should have been given the right to join AMD in the alternative so that we could take advantage of the litigation that did happen. There was a significant amount of litigation that transpired, and we shouldn't have to start all over, and we shouldn't lose a year's worth of damages. If I might, just briefly, I know I don't have much time, but on this issue of standing, this was in no way a hunting license. Here's why. We got ownership of the patents with absolutely no obligation to do anything with them. It's different than all of the cases like Diamond Coating and ProPat, where the plaintiff had affirmative obligations to enforce and license the patents or face risk of termination. Our client could have done nothing with these patents because it's the owner. It also had the right as the owner to covenant not to sue certain companies, covenant not to sue AMD. It was an owner like every other patent owner who has the right to decide what to do and what not to do with its patents. Lone Star absolutely had the right to practice. I'm surprised that it's still even an issue because the appellants have conceded this point in their brief.
Is Lone Star what we call a non-practicing entity?
Yeah, yes, they don't practice these patents, and for that matter, there's no evidence that AMD does either. But to me, that's completely irrelevant. Under the Supreme Court's Crown Dye decision, the owner of an invention has the natural common law right to practice the invention. The grant clauses here specifically include all rights in and to the inventions, not just the patents. As the owner of the inventions, Lone Star had a common law right to practice them. The whole purpose of the patent is to then give it the right to exclude others from practicing so it can enjoy its natural right to use.
Doesn't that status lend to the definition of the hunting license?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't the NPE status lend to the definition of the hunting license?
No, Your Honor, I guess I have a sort of a moral objection to all attempts to characterize MPEs in a pejorative way by referring to this as a hunting license or anything like that. My client is a licensing entity. This agreement was an absolutely proper transfer of rights, and the mechanism that limited my client's rights to sue certain companies was simply a mechanism to make sure that Lone Star didn't sue companies that already had rights under these patents. That was a very pragmatic and laudable way of structuring the agreement. And it's no different than any other circumstance where a patent owner decides not to pursue certain companies for whatever reason it chooses. That is the fundamental right of ownership that Abbott confirmed, the right to indulge infringement. And of course, any party that already has license rights through a previous agreements with AMD, my client has no claim and has no constitutional standing to pursue those claims.
Can you conclude for us?
Well, in conclusion, Your Honor, we obviously believe that the court got the standing issue wrong and the case should be reversed on that basis, but in the alternative, we should have at least had the opportunity to join AMD, and none of the reasons that have been argued for why we were denied the joinder are none of those are valid reasons. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.